Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Order has almost been restored. Two guests today, though with a postscript from the third. We'll hear from Jody Dean, a frequent Behind the News guest who's been suspended from her teaching duties for writing a controversial article, and then from the historian Carrie Lee Merritt about the serious problems of society in the American South. And as a postscript, we'll hear a bit of an interview first broadcast last June with the economist Samuel Bazzi on the effects of the Confederate diaspora on recipient areas. The crackdown in dissenting voices around Israel's war on Gaza, a crime perpetrated with the generous assistance of the U.S., has been remarkable, though similar must be said about the level of dissent. One instance that strikes close to home, my friend and frequent Behind the News guest Jody Dean was suspended from teaching by the administration of Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, for an article she wrote for the Verso blog that defended Hamas. It's not the article I would have written, but whether I agree with it or not is irrelevant. A professor should not be punished for a controversial article. But that's where we are. Here's Jody Dean with the story. So, Jody, what happened? How'd you find out? What's been happening to you? What's the college doing to you?
So, I'll start from the beginning. On April 9th, the Verso blog published an essay of mine, Palestine Speaks for Everyone. And I guess 2 days later, I started getting notices that some different right-wing and Zionist Twitter accounts were on it and were criticizing it and sharing it a lot with a lot of outrage. And then in one of the threads, someone essentially doxed me. Now, that's not hard. I mean, I've written a bunch.
Well, you're a very public figure. It's not hard to find out where you are.
But I hadn't put the name of where I teach on the Verso blog, right? I just kept it, you know, me. I live in Geneva, New York. So these Twitter accounts then started putting, they put my picture up and calling out me. And then the president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, Mark Guerin, and then calling on HWS to fire me. You know, I'm a horrible anti-Semite. I'm vile. I celebrate death. And so they started circulating these things. And then I started noticing, oh, I was getting a fair amount of really awful hate mail. And so I was like, this isn't great. This was Thursday night. And then on Friday morning, I get a call from HWS that lets me know that, in fact, an account with over 300,000 followers had been circulating these calls against me, and that all of HWS social media was getting responses and getting basically anti-Jody, you know, hate Jody Dean things all over them. And so they were having to do a combination of whack-a-mole and cutting off comments and that kind of thing. And then on Friday afternoon, the president of the colleges began the faculty meeting by condemning me. So that's a first, not just for me. I don't think it's ever been done at the beginning of a faculty meeting.
Now, had you ever been identified by Canary Mission or any of those?
No. I mean, not at all, right? I mean, a lot of really wonderful scholars and brave students, all sorts of people have been called out. I've never been called out for on Canary Mission or anything like that. So, you know, I was condemned. I wasn't at the faculty meeting, which is probably a good thing because it would have felt really awkward. The Zoom link, for whatever reason, wasn't working. So then the next day, I got called into the office of the president and was read a letter, which I at the time didn't ask, you know, who was it going to? I don't know why I didn't ask. I was more interested in, like, what did the condemnation actually say? And it was like, oh, well, I'll read this and it'll say that. And then after all of the critical part, it's like, and something to the effect of, and Jody Dean is being relieved of teaching responsibilities pending an investigation in the interest of, and I'm paraphrasing now, in the interest of the safety and well-being of the students. And I was pretty shocked. I didn't realize that the Verso blog was that dangerous.
This use of safety is so wild because, you know, it used to be like, oh, those all these leftish snowflakes can handle tough speech. Howard French, a former New York Times reporter, has been posting on Twitter today all these columns by New York Times columnists about this very topic. Like, the kids today are just too sensitive and they want to be safe and they need to take it a little rough. And now you have these apologists for imperial slaughter embracing that very discourse.
Yeah, I think it's on the one hand gaslighting, on the other hand, you know, whatever tools that we release out into the universe can get picked up by our adversaries. It's just particularly galling right now seeing the bravery of the students all over the country. What is it, like 16, 17 colleges and universities have students? They're putting themselves at a lot of risk. I mean, there are specific campaigns to dox these students, to prevent their future employment. You know, hundreds have now been arrested. So the snowflake thing, I think we really have to, just kind of say, okay, wait a minute, all you guys, like, let's look at these brave students. I mean, it's really, really impressive. And I don't think the right wing is going to be able to use that anymore because now basically who looks like a snowflake more than they do?
Yeah. Your status is now pending investigation. Do you have any idea of what the scope of that investigation is? Who's performing it?
So let me talk about this one kind of vaguely.
Okay.
Because one of the things that's been really helpful as this has happened is I've been able to connect and talk with other scholars and academics who have gone through this kind of thing. And one of the things that people who are enduring this are sharing is the way that these processes are being made up. They're usually completely ad hoc. Most of the time, there's not good kind of language or process or sort of bylaws or rules that tell how to do this. And so it seems to me like what happens is that universities cast a wide net and go on fishing expeditions to see what they can catch. So the investigations that I'm familiar with are doing precisely that thing, looking to see if anyone could possibly be harmed. So actually that was in the letter that the president of HWS sent. I should have said this part. On Saturday, the president of Hobart and Williams-Smith Colleges released this letter about like condemning me and saying, you know, HWS has nothing to do with that, which is, of course it didn't. It was my article. And saying I was relieved and released it to all the students, the faculty, the staff, the parents, and all the alumni. Right. So this then went, and then of course it was immediately circulating. So this letter about my employment was widely publicized online and it was sent to the entire community. And in that it said that they would be investigating to make sure that no one could have been possibly at risk or something like that. So looking for to make sure that anyone may have been harmed, that they would find them.
On the face of it, this seems like an academic freedom issue. You're a tenured professor, a distinguished scholar and writer with a pretty high public profile. You would think you would have the freedom to say pretty much anything you'd want. Obviously, that has some limits. How does this fit into traditional notions of academic freedom?
Well, the American Association of University Professors has already weighed in on this in a letter to HWS saying that this is an incredible violation of academic freedom. I'm very pleased that they wrote so quickly in my behalf that this is what academic freedom is supposed to protect, which is the ability to raise critical questions, to think freely, to explore ideas, and particular ideas that may not be popular, particularly critical ideas, ideas that are critical of a dominant view. I mean, the interesting thing about academic freedom is it's not just like anything goes, say whatever you want, anytime. What it means is opening up the space for thinking and critique and thoughtfulness and inquiry and exchange and exploration, a kind of like an interpretive dialogue to understand. And that's what's really being shut down by going after a tenured professor for a blog post.
Now, I don't want to take away anything from what you're going through, but now academia is populated by very casualized adjuncts. And if this is happening to you, a tenured professor with a global reputation, they have no freedom at all, right?
Oh, absolutely. I was talking with a colleague just today who was describing some cases out in California where really vicious Zionist groups were going after contingent laborers who were women of color and looking through their syllabi and seeing if they could find anything to go after them and to try to get their jobs. And it's very hard to protect contingent faculty because they don't have long-term contracts. When the president of Columbia called out untenured faculty member in her presentation, it's just completely vile the way this is happening. And they don't have the same protections at all. And this is actually one of these intersections of the kind of neoliberalization of the university and the elimination of tenured jobs and the moving to more and more contingent labor. Without that, I think we would actually be in a different ballgame. But that sort of 40 years of attacks on higher ed, the moving over to fewer and fewer tenured positions and more adjunct positions means that people don't have the protections of thought. They're not able to write and teach, which then is really bad for students who don't get to explore different ideas.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, who's been suspended from her teaching duties at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. It's worth pointing out that the president of Columbia, when she was president of LSE, London School of Economics, expanded the contingent workforce there at a time when other British universities were actually expanding their permanent workforce. So she really went out of her way to impose this new neoliberal model, even against what was happening in the wider culture there.
It's completely vile and unfortunately not really surprising. One of the things we should be worried about is that what more and more trustees want, right? Are trustees actively dismantling education and just turning them into their own depositories for some kinds of money so they can have like, oh, I'll have a building in my name. I'll create a workforce or a populace that reflects the ideas that I want. I mean, it seems like that's where it's going.
Now, I was just reflecting on Yale of my era. Early 1970s. Kingman Brewster, very aristocratic, double Mayflower president of Yale at the time, diffused a whole lot of campus tensions. There was a trial of some Black Panthers going on in New Haven. Brewster tells the press, I don't think a Black revolutionary can get a fair trial anywhere in the United States. He says some sympathetic things. This diffuses a whole lot of the anger on campus and prevented, riots basically from happening. The contrast with the college and university president of today is really striking. It seems, as you mentioned, the money bags guys seem much more directly involved. And the top officials themselves are just bureaucrats. Shafiq came out of the IMF and the Bank of England. These are not, career educators. They don't seem to have much in the way of an understanding of intellectual life or how to handle the complex politics of a university without calling the cops.
I've been wondering, is this going to be part of like the New World Order? Not to use the old, I don't mean from the old George Bush New World Order times, but just, whatever this time of extreme repression is, and I expect will get worse as inequality continues to deepen and, we've got rampant climate change. But anyway, I'm wondering if the new model is going to be coercion. It's like there's not a model of discussion and inquiry anymore, but the model will be, if you don't do what we want, we're going to police you. If you're a faculty member and you don't say what we like, we will fire you. If you are a student and you break our bizarre and elaborate regulations regarding when and where you can speak, then you will be arrested. I actually wonder if what we're seeing is a kind of grim new time where the universities aren't what they should be or what they were. But on the other hand, not to be so grim, the students fighting back are actually, I think, giving us the other side of it and another kind of hope that they're not going to let that happen, that they're going to insist on spaces of freedom.
Yeah, they're absolutely inspiring. I mean, whenever Columbia has been following it most closely because it's just around the corner from me practically, but I've been watching these students with great admiration. Like whenever Columbia tightens the screws, they just redouble their efforts.
It's exhilarating. It's totally exhilarating. It's persistent. I also really was just blown away by the bravery of the faculty surrounding the students at NYU and being the first line of defense and getting arrested. I mean, that's pretty great. And I hope that we see this at all the other colleges and universities, that we'll see more and more faculty stand up. Because really, the more people come out, the weaker that the administrations and the trustees are, right? I don't think they can arrest us all.
No. I just saw that the NYPD had trouble. The bus drivers wouldn't drive the buses to take the arrested to jail. And so the cops are trying to drive the bus by themselves and were having a very hard time doing it, which was a very cheering little detail.
Oh, that's cheery. It also, not to get all, commie revolution on this, but those kinds of connections, right, where other groups start to express solidarity and start to refuse to comply, that's a really great kind of building of social solidarity and building a fight back that's also totally inspiring.
I'm amazed by what's been going on with this since October 7th, that it feels very McCarthyite. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say it feels like McCarthyism all over again. But McCarthyism was about communism, which was really about something. I mean, we can make fun of some of the crazy delusions that McCarthy and the people like him, trafficked in, but it really was about something. I don't fully understand why this particular issue has provoked such an intense crackdown by the American political and educational elite. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Solidarity with Palestine is impermissible. Right? Solidarity with Palestine is what the U.S. Academy and the U.S. state has said. No, we know from Biden, it's like he calls himself a Zionist and says that if Israel wasn't there, we'd have to invent it. And billions of dollars that continue to go in to fund this genocide. It's like the hold on the American political system and all of the elite is this utter exclusion of Palestinian self-determination and Palestinian freedom from the imperial world order. I really fully believe it is the commitment to Palestinian freedom that is at the heart of it. And why? It's also because the Palestinian cause is at the core of anti-imperialism as well. And it's completely inspiring and great. I was at the University of Rochester encampment yesterday, and to see the students there, I think it's very much like on the other campuses, that it was an extraordinarily diverse group of students there. It did not look like, your typical white group. It was all sorts of different multinational students, multigendered, other people from the community. And it just made you see like this core of solidarity with Palestine as uniting multiple movements.
It does seem like some elite campuses are taking the lead in these protests. Do you have any thoughts why that might be?
Yeah, I've wondered a couple of things. I wondered if in part that because they may have more international students and international students. I mean, that's an empirical question. One can do research on that, but that would be a guess. A lot of international students who come from political cultures where protest is common and normative and encouraged. I think that might be one reason. I've also wondered whether a relative amount of privilege that students at elite colleges have may make them freer to demonstrate. They may be less worried about their economic futures than, say, students who go to commuter colleges or who are working a full-time job as they're going to school or who are continuing education students. And so it could be that the students at the elite universities have a degree of privilege that frees them to protest.
Yeah, this whole concept of privilege is very complicated in politics. Sometimes if you use it properly, it's a weapon rather than something to be embarrassed about.
Absolutely. That's one of the things I actually think that tenured faculty have a duty to be out there, and many, many are out there speaking in solidarity with Palestine and in support of all of our students. And it can't just be that this is on the backs of contingent faculty, like who are the ones, you know, taking the brunt of the pushback.
So what kind of reaction have you been getting? Are you getting messages of support from near and afar? How's it been?
You won't be surprised to know that not everyone has been supportive. I've gotten quite a bit of nasty, nasty, nasty hate mail, but the support has really drowned that out and helped me a great deal. You know, my good friend and comrade, Albena Osmanova, put together a sign-on letter and petition that got over 4,000 signatures, and that really was very, very helpful. And on campus, the Students for Academic Freedom group put together a letter that they sent to the administration, and faculty put together a long letter with many faculty supporting. Our branch, AUP, put together a letter. So all of that has been really great. And oh my God, I've gotten beautiful letters from alumni, from parents, from students, and also from a friend who's an activist in Israel. She has relatives who were in the south of Israel and displaced for quite a while, and she knows people who are hostages. And she wrote in full solidarity with my Verso blog post and wrote a letter to the president on my behalf, which I thought was an incredible act of generosity.
People are listening who want to help you out either emotionally or in any other way. Is there something they could do?
Yeah, they could write letters to the president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges and say that academic freedom matters, and it really matters in a genocide, that we have to demonstrate solidarity with the Palestinian struggle and recognize, and this is actually what my friend Dana says, the activist from Tel Aviv. She's like, nobody is safe if Palestine's not safe. That Jewish people in the United States are not safe because of, you know, Israel's like genocidal assault on Palestine. And they're not safe anywhere given that assault. And so it's important that we recognize this and that we recognize the absolute, absolutely essential nature of solidarity with the Palestine struggle. So I think writing HWS could be useful, or there's a change.org petition for my reinstatement that's circulating online.
That was Jody Dean, a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, who's been suspended from her teaching duties because the administration of the college didn't like an article she wrote. If you'd like to file a note of support for Jody, the email address of the president of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, Mark Guerin, is Guerin, G-E-A-R-A-N, at hws.edu, G-E-A-R-A-N, at hws.edu. A CC to Catherine Williams, vice president for marketing and communications, C. Williams at hws.edu, might also be in order. Though we talked some about the initial wave of protests emerging at elite institutions, the Gaza solidarity encampments are spreading. As I was putting the finishing touches in this show this morning, I saw that students at City College of New York were setting one up. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of the second movement of the String Quartet No. 1 by the Italian composer Giacinto Scelsi, performed by the Arditi Quartet. Next, the severe structural problems of the American South. My next guest, Carrie Lee Merritt, has an article on the Eon website, The Southern Gap, on the lingering effects of the antebellum order on Southern society. She's a historian and writer based in Atlanta. Carrie Lee Merritt. You say in the piece, whether measured in terms of development, health, or happiness, the region is bad at everything good and good at everything bad. That's quite a broad indictment. Could you expand on that a little bit?
So I say the region is bad at everything good and good at everything bad. And of course, that is painting with a broad stroke, but that's the actual data. That's what the data tells us. If we look at anything from economic data to health and well-being to any kind of development data, the South is always the lowest, you know, on the spectrum, always the worst. And the Deep South, the states where slavery was the highest, those states are the worst out of the region.
Yeah, there seems to be an awful lot of continuity in the social structures that prevailed before 1865 and after, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously the legacies of slavery, but all of the other forms of unfree labor that accompanied slavery and persisted long after slavery, from debt peonage to child indenture laws, to the fact that they actually indentured white people for hundreds of years as well, especially in the South, in the Deep South. And so the legacies of these kinds of unfree labor coupled with the deep and abiding racism really set the entire region back in so many ways and has continued to hold us back even today.
You quote Du Bois saying, even among the 2 million slaveholders, an oligarchy of 8,000 really ruled the South. They really ruled everything, right? All aspects of social life in the South.
They ruled everything, and they honestly, their heirs still do. There's a very small cadre of families that, especially in rural areas in the South, own not only kind of the local government and everyone who runs the local government, but also the banks. So they're the people that are in charge of loans. They own the housing complexes and the places to live. So they decide whether or not you get to rent from them and at what prices. These are people that not only basically own a monopoly of companies, they also own a monopsony in terms of labor power that in these rural areas, especially if you don't have an education, there's just no one to work for besides these few powerful families that own everything. And so, you know, unless there's some sort of governmental intervention, this structure will not change, and it hasn't changed. I mean, we've seen the persistence. Every time there has been actual progress in the South, it has come at the federal government's insistence on making it progress in certain ways.
And these guys, the original slaveholders and their descendants, the slaveholders and their families really curated their bloodlines, right? They made sure to preserve the family as family and its social position.
Yeah, it was crazy. People think of, you know, today the modern stereotype is of poor whites and Appalachian whites being the inbred, you know, kind of hicks. And that's actually the opposite. The people that were the most inbred and kept, they were actually very obsessed with blood lineage and, you know, considered themselves an aristocracy. And so wanted to keep all of the wealth and power within these few families. I mean, you see their bloodlines and it's, you know, it's a tree without any branches, essentially, because they knew that this was the key to keeping the South and, you know, their slave empires, essentially. Like, we really have to start seeing slavery as these little fiefdoms. You know, it wasn't run by the federal government. These rural areas were lorded over by the biggest slaveholders, and they controlled everything. And like I argue in this article, their descendants today still control, because they have access to all of the land and power and money in those areas, still control almost everything.
Now, there's a school of history that arose in recent years, recent decades, rather. It's echoed in the 1619 Project idea that slavery was essential for economic growth in American history. And it said pretty much that slavery and capitalism went together, like love and marriage. But the truth is somewhat more complicated, isn't it? Like, slavery was a bit of an anomaly in a capitalist system. How do they reconcile these things?
Right. So, I mean, there are so many different streams of thought about this, and there's a different stream of thought that comes from people writing in the 1940s and 50s, and especially from Black scholars who are writing from the West Indies and these former colonial societies that were ruled over by slavery. And then, of course, we have what's called the New History of Capitalism, which were scholars primarily out of Ivy League schools writing in the late 2000s, 2010s. And
could you name some names? Like, who are we talking about?
Sure. Sven Beckert and Ed Baptist and Seth Rockman, primarily all white men who were mostly criticized from black scholars who said, you know, that they weren't giving these older scholars from the 1940s and 50s and even 60s their intellectual due. But what kind of happened was that in this making slavery and capitalism marketable to the masses, a lot of nuance got left out. And a lot of that nuance was really centered on how underdeveloped the South is, and that in making America rich, it wasn't truly slavery. It was unfree labor, and unfree labor persisted in many, many different forms over a long period of time. And you know, wasn't just African Americans, obviously, because you have instances of this in the West with Native Americans all the time. And so we look at how that complicated system really is something that occurs in fits and starts. And if you predicate your definition of capitalism on labor power, on laborers actually having the ability to choose who they work for, then you can't classify slavery as strict capitalism. And so there's a long history of this. It gets very complicated. But really up until the 2000s, with this new history of capitalism, scholars and economists and historians all really said that the South wasn't fully capitalist in a way that we consider it today until after World War II.
Yeah, but the products that it produced with slave labor were very crucial to the development of Northern capitalism, but also British capitalism. Turning cotton into textiles and clothing was really very crucial to early industrialization. What exactly is its relation? Was it just the slave system embedded in a larger capitalist structure, but it wasn't fully capitalist itself?
Right, absolutely. It fed, the old argument is that it fed capitalism, essentially, that it, the South was more of a feudalistic society, but it fed industrial capitalism. And you see this by planters, you know, keeping industrial capitalism out of the South explicitly. Like, they could have made a higher rate of return by industrializing during slavery, and they chose not to in order to keep the South rural, in order to keep those racial and class hierarchies that they already had in place. But yeah, there's no question that it made America incredibly rich. But I think what the main point that gets lost in this conversation is it made a very, very small percentage of Americans very, very rich. And in what it did essentially was increase wealth inequality, you know, exponentially, and really make the South an incredibly poor and underdeveloped region for centuries, not only because of slavery, but because of, as I talk about in the article, what happens after slavery, which is that the region is capital starved and they have to start courting these northern companies and northern capitalists in. And, you know, these companies basically come in and it's almost like a colonial economy. You know, you're draining the profits back to the north or to wherever the companies are headquartered.
Yeah, it really is like an internal colony in the sense that primary products, value extraction through primary products, but not much reinvestment locally, and absentee landlords and profiteers are the ones who get really rich off it. A small class in the colony get rich, but there's no way that the region itself could be called rich by conventional measures.
Right. And again, we're seeing this crisis play out today. All of these states. I was born in Mississippi. That state is the last state on every single list, like I said, for anything bad. And the maternal mortality rates in that state are on par with places like rural Mexico and, you know, rural Caribbean places. That's the state of our healthcare in some of these southern states. And with the new laws that are being passed against women and, you know, with all of the Deep South Southern governors keeping Medicaid expansion from entering the states. I mean, it's just, we're seeing death rates just skyrocket, and it's going to keep getting worse unless there's some kind of major federal intervention.
I'm speaking with the historian, Carrie Lee Merritt. The slaveocracy, the ruling class of the South before emancipation, really pushed low levels of public investment, low taxation, low education, and not just for the slaves, but for poor whites as well. These policy preferences have persisted 160 years later.
Right. They basically invested as little as possible in their local communities. And when they did, it was very much into the police state. So you know, the South is building jails and prisons while the North is building schools and asylums and places for the deaf and, you know, the blind. And you really see this kind of division of what counts as a public good, you know, as early as the colonial period, but certainly into late antebellum period. There's not even public schools in the Deep South for white people in the late antebellum period. There's literally no system of public schooling. So what our ideas of what's going on in America in the Jacksonian period that all white men are voting, like they don't apply to the Deep South. It was a completely different place governed by completely different rules. And even if we look at the actual laws that are in place, that's not what's happening on the ground. You know, like I said, these are little fiefdoms. The slaveholders, the big slaveholders control everything.
But, you know, we see now the hostility to public schools and, you know, voucher systems and all these schemes for defunding the public schools and creating some kind of private system. That is spreading across the country. I mean, that's pretty standard right-wing politics, pretty standard libertarian politics. How did this kind of influence spread north and west?
I and other labor historians in the South have argued for years that there's what we call the Southernization of America really happening in terms of labor laws and work opportunities, in that the rest of the country has basically been pulled down to our standards instead of us being raised up, you know, to the standards that we've previously held as a country. These policies are meant to divide a labor force, to keep a labor force undereducated and uneducated, to keep people from realizing real history, real civics, and learning how to work politically to band together across racial lines in class solidarity and to make any real changes in America. And it's proven to be an incredibly effective way to control the masses. You know, you cut off education, you cut off opportunity, you cut off the ability for them to earn, you know, even a living wage, and you cut off so much of people's hopes and dreams and even their willingness to be involved in a democratic political system.
Now, you look at the South today, it seems developed, thriving, strong population growth, you know, it looks prosperous. City like Atlanta looks very much in line with the modern 21st century city. You're seeing large amounts of migration to the South. How real is this picture?
Well, it's very skewed. You know, I mean, there are certainly cities that are doing well, like Atlanta, like Charlotte, in the Deep South. But overwhelmingly, you know, I always ask people from outside the region, have they ever been through the rural South, like really driven through the rural South? Have they gone through the Mississippi Delta? Because, I mean, if you're in those areas, and I've been through much of our country, you drive through these areas in the Deep South and you feel like you're still in the days of slavery. That's how little even just the general landscape has changed. It's incredible the kind of staying power of the slaveocracy and the fact that hundreds of years later, we're still living in this state of underdevelopment in one of the richest country in the world. And the fact that this is happening is nothing short of, you know, a moral failure.
But the region seems long to have had a very disproportionate influence in national politics. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, the South controlled everything before the Civil War. Even after losing power for a few years during early Reconstruction, what I argue is one of the biggest mistakes in our country's history was the fact that nothing was done, you know, to the leaders of the Confederacy and these major slaveholders. And so that was really the problem, that their land wasn't taken away. There wasn't any punishment for leading an open insurrection against the government. And so really, again, these people are back in power with their same, now they don't have slave forces, but they still own all the land. And so because they own all the land in the South, they're able to still control the workforces, because literally people have nowhere else to go, nowhere else to live. And it just turns into this self-perpetuating cyclical, either poverty or great wealth, this incredible wealth inequality. And these few cities that are shining examples of prosperity in the South, you know, these are the exceptions. And even if you go into these cities, it's, you know, what they're showing you on the outside is not exactly what it looks like on the inside.
Yeah, I recall a phrase from Du Bois's Black Reconstruction. He quotes somebody saying, there should have been dozens of hangings. There really weren't dozens of hangings, and maybe there should have been.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what has brought us to this level, is that these people were never punished. And I think it's an incredibly important political lesson for us today, is what happens when you don't punish the leaders of a major insurrection. And I mean, we see what's happened.
So how do we reconstruct the South? How do we bring it into a more advanced state?
I think we definitely need a third reconstruction. If we talk about reconstructions as federal government increasing the rights and livelihoods of the masses of people, then the first reconstruction, obviously, was right after the Civil War. And the second reconstruction would have been the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s, where the federal government really stepped in and made states abide by federal law. So we need a third reconstruction that does a lot of things. My biggest goal would be that people would have health care as a basic minimum in these southern states, and that there would be some sort of either federal jobs guarantee or some kind of state jobs guarantee where people have the opportunity to work for an employer who treats them well, who pays them a decent wage, who gives them benefits, somebody outside of the monopsonistic people that rule their local counties or local governments.
But it seems like a second Trump administration, which is seeming more and more like a realistic possibility, would empower these worst elements of the slaveocracy or the neo-slaveocracy.
Absolutely. And it obviously then plays too on people's loneliness, on people's isolation, on people's feelings of being left out of America, which are at obviously their peak since COVID. But the divisions we're facing today are incredibly scary. And as a historian, I mean, I've said this since 2016, but we really are at a crossroads in our nation's history. And we need to be looking back at things like the Civil War, but especially, I think, Reconstruction. People ask all the time, are we going to erupt in another Civil War? I don't think so. I think it's going to look more like Reconstruction, where there are very targeted pockets of violence and very targeted political acts of violence in certain areas that will last over possibly decades to come. But that's kind of the terrain, I think, that we're getting into, and we have been in the last few years, really.
Yeah, when people talk about January 6th and the efforts to overturn an election as somehow historically unprecedented, that was really popular in the South, wasn't it, in the late 19th century?
Right. That was the irony, right, was that January 6th was actually the first time there was a Confederate flag in the White House, in the Capitol. And that was the first time there was a Confederate flag in the Capitol, was that Kevin Seyfried, who was on all the magazine covers. And so, yeah, in so many ways, I think the Trump administration and those guys have done a fantastic job of using this ahistorical wrong history in order to motivate people to join their cause. And this is something, again, that we've seen throughout all of history. The areas in the South today that are the most pro-Confederate are actually the areas where there were the least Confederates and the most Unionists and the most anti-Confederates. And so,
how did that happen?
Because history has been so distorted, number one, in the way it's taught and the way what people believe, but also because of money, quite frankly. My friend Adam Dombey has a great book about how Confederate pensions actually drove a lot of Southern families to claim that they were Confederates when, in fact, they never were.
It's very easy for Yankees to get snooty and condescending about the South. We just think of a bunch of hicks and yokels and superstitious snake handlers and all kinds of caricatures about the region. How can we separate the truth from that kind of bigoted version of events?
Well, I mean, certainly there's truth to all of those stereotypes, I think, but you have to understand the South as a place of deep, deep poverty and deep suffering that lasts for generations, for centuries, and a type of suffering and a type of shame and humiliation that no other section of the country has really experienced, and I think has never been properly dealt with within the South or within America. And, there's a lot psychologically that I think white people in the South need to work on themselves. But there's a lot that Americans need to work on, and understanding that how undereducation, how miseducation, how outright lies and hatred, and being raised in a culture of hatred and being raised in a culture of violence, how that impacts people from birth, how hard it is to leave that, right? How hard it is to leave that culture and be ostracized and be a free thinker in that culture. And there are lots of good people down here doing the hard work that needs to be done, and they're maybe not profiled or not heard of within different parts of the South, but it's being done, and there are good people here that want to make our region prosperous and make our people happy, and we're working hard to do that.
That was a historian and writer, Carrie Lee Merritt. You can find her article on the EON website, aeon.co. We talked some about the southernization of the U.S. For a long-term view of that, here's a bit of an interview I did with the economist Samuel Bazzi last June. He's one of five co-authors of a paper on the long-term effects of the post-Civil War dispersion of Southerners to other parts of the country. The effects were profound and lingering, measurable increases in racial violence and stratification. Bazzi is an associate professor at the University of California, San Diego's School of Global Policy and Strategy. How big was this diaspora?
The Confederate diaspora, as we're calling it. Our best estimates suggest that upwards of around 1 million Southern whites left the American South, the former Confederate states and allied territory in Oklahoma, between about 1870 and 1900. So we're talking about 1 million people. And within that, we're able to estimate that roughly 60,000 former slaveholders and about another 120,000 or so of their household kin within that broader set of white migrants out of the South in that 30-year period right after the end of the Civil War.
And then where did they tend to go, both regions and the types of communities they settled in?
They largely went west. Of course, they went to border states, which were naturally the most proximate destinations for those leaving the former Confederacy. But they really seemed to have gravitated out west and largely avoided, the heart of former Union territory up in New England and kind of the upper Midwest, but really seemed to have settled by and large in a lot of what at the time was the American frontier, places that were being newly incorporated as the country was pushing westward.
And the kind of communities?
It varied. Some of them were settling in larger established towns, mining towns throughout the West, but a lot of them were really settling in nascent communities, places that had some viable agricultural land, or other potential resources for fresh economic activities, and really playing a big role in many places that for the first time were receiving large influxes of white settlers from all over America, but in this case, from the American South, which had just been devastated, of course, during the many battles of the American Civil War.
And a lot of them chose occupations that put them in positions of influence.
That's right. And so if you compare the kind of average Southerner to anyone else living in these communities where they settled, they tended to be overrepresented in what we're calling positions of authority. Think about lawyers and judges. Think about local officials working in public administration. Think about your local religious leaders. And so you can really see this kind of outsized presence of these members of the Confederate diaspora. And within that, we can even dig deeper and see that former enslavers were even more likely to be taking on these positions of authority in these new communities where they settled.
So you found in a lot of these recipient areas really significant increases in lynchings, incarceration rates, just real material evidence of a much more racist culture than surrounding areas that didn't necessarily have that level of Confederate penetration.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. As economists, we're in many ways bringing data to a lot of what historians have told and kind of carefully documented themselves. But really what we're able to do is trace out a direct causal link between this influx of migrants from the former Confederate states and see this subsequent increase in racial violence and Confederate memorialization and really the propagation of a set of institutions and cultural norms that were very unfavorable, to put it mildly, to Black populations. And that, of course, at this early stage of institutional development can have profound implications for the subsequent evolution of culture and norms and institutional practices in these places.
And a lot of the effects on social indicators persist into the present as well, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, one thing we're able to see is as early as in the early 1900s, we're able to trace out a distinct influence of former slaveholders in particular working in these positions of authority and creating adverse outcomes in the form of higher incarceration rates for for Black men in the early 20th century. And then if we kind of trace that forward all the way to modern data on racial gaps in incarceration, we still see that kind of persistent legacy going back to the early Confederate diaspora and especially to the former enslavers within that diaspora. And so it materializes in the carceral state and in racial gaps in incarceration, as well as in greater inequity in the labor market in terms of racial wage inequality and in terms of persistent racial segregation, which is, of course, has its roots in a number of forces and kind of practices and that differ in urban and rural America, but are certainly part and parcel of that early legacy of these white settlers from the South.
And finally, what does your work say about the claim that Confederate nostalgia is about heritage and not hate?
Yeah, that's the tough question, I think. But certainly, as far as our empirical findings are concerned, they seem to go hand in hand. And so it's very, I would say, very difficult to look at our findings and suggest that there's somehow a distinction between a benign effort to memorialize one's fallen ancestors and the very real and persistent effects of these racially divisive figures and institutions from the former Confederacy, the role they're having in public spaces and in the minds of local residents and citizens of these communities. You do see this tight connection. In the past year or two, there's been a number of efforts to kind of understand what happens when some of these monuments are removed. Do we see changes in racial attitudes? Do we see changes in other forms of racial inequity? And so I think that work, is still very much in progress, but I'm excited about what we're going to learn from hopefully more of these removals of these divisive monuments and iconography across the U.S.
Samuel Bazzi, Associate Professor at the University of California San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy, and co-author of a National Bureau of Economic Research working paper on the effects of the Confederate diaspora on the rest of the country. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more of Giacinto Scelsi's String Quartet No. 1, this from the fourth movement, performed by the Arditi Quartet. Till next week, bye.